is what we exist for." His voice rang out. "I shall go forth into the mundane world. I will strip the memories of those close to the Daylighter. They will remember him only as mortal. They will not remember Clary at all."
"No," Clary shouted, and Asmodeus threw his head back and laughed, a dazzling laugh that made her remember that he had once been an angel.
"You can't take our memories," said Isabel furiously. "We're Nephilim. It would be tantamount to an attack. The clay
"Your memories you may keep," said Asmodeus. "Nothing about your remembering Simon will get me in trouble with the clave. And besides, it will torment you, which only doubles my pleasure." He grinned. "I shall rip a hole through the heart of your world, and when you feel it, you will think on me and remember me. Remember."
Asmodeus pulled Simon close, his hand sliding up to press against Simon's chest, as if he could reach up through his ribcage into his heart.
"We begin here. Are you ready, Daylighter?"
"Stop!"
Isabel stepped forward, her whip in hand, her eyes burning.
"We know your name, demon. Do you think I'm afraid to slay even a prince of hell? I would hang your head on my wall like a trophy, and if you dare touch Simon, I will hunt you down. I will spend my life hunting you."
Alec wrapped his arms around his sister and held her tightly.
"Isabel," he said quietly, "no." "What do you mean, no?" Clary demanded. "We can't let this happen. Jace!"
"This is Simon's choice."
Jace stood stock still. He was ashy pale, but unmoving. His eyes were locked on Simon's.
"We have to honor it."
Simon looked back at Jace and inclined his head. His gaze was moving slowly over all of them, flicking from Magnus to Alec, to Jace, to Isabel, where it stopped and rested, and was so full of broken possibilities that Clary felt her own heart break. And then his gaze moved to Clary, and she felt the rest of her shatter. There was so much in his expression, so many years of so much love, so many whispered secrets and promises and shared dreams. She saw him reach down, and then something bright arced through the air toward her. She reached up and caught it reflexively. It was the golden ring Clary had given him. Her hand tightened around it, feeling the bite of metal against her palm, welcoming the pain.
"Enough," said Asmodeus. "I hate goodbyes."
And he tightened his grip on Simon. Simon gasped, his eyes flying wide open. His hand went to his chest.
"My heart,"
he gasped. And Clary knew from the look on his face, that it had started beating again. She blinked against her tears as a white mist exploded up around them. She heard Simon cry out in pain. Her own feet moved without volition and she ran forward, only to be hurled back as if she had struck an invisible wall. Someone caught her. Jace, she thought. There were arms around her, even as the mist circled Simon and the demon like a small tornado, half blocking them from view. Shapes began to appear in the mist as it thickened. Clary saw herself and Simon as children, holding hands, crossing a street in Brooklyn. She had barrettes in her hair, and Simon was adorably rumpled, his glasses sliding off his nose. There they were again, throwing snowballs in Prospect Park, and at Luke's farmhouse, tanned from summer, hanging upside down from tree branches. She saw them in Java Jones, listening to Eric's terrible poetry, and on the back of a flying motorcycle as it crashed into a parking lot, with Jace there looking at them, his eyes squinted against the sun. And there was Simon with Isabel, his hands curved around her face, kissing her, and she could see Isabel as Simon saw her, fragile and strong, and so, so beautiful. And there was Valentine's ship, Simon kneeling on Jace, blood on his mouth and shirt, and blood at Jace's throat. And there was the cell in Idris, and Hodge's weathered face, and Simon and Clary again. Clary etching the mark of Cain onto his forehead. Maureen, and her blood on the floor, and her little pink hat, and the rooftop in Manhattan where Lilith had raised Sebastian. And Clary was passing him a gold ring across a table, and an angel was rising out of a lake before him, and he was kissing Isabel.
All Simon's memories, his memories of magic, his memories of all of them, being drawn out and spun into a skein. It shimmered, as white gold as daylight. There was a sound around all of them, like a gathering storm, but Clary barely heard it. She reached her hands out, beseeching, though she didn't know who she was begging.
Please.
She felt Jace's arms tighten around her, and then the edge of the storm caught her. She was lifted up, whirled away. She saw the stone room recede into the distance at a terrible speed, and the storm took her cries for Simon and turned them into a sound like the ragged tearing of wind. Jace's hands were torn from her shoulders. She was alone in the chaos, and for a moment she thought Asmodeus had lied to them after all, that there was no gateway, and that they would float in this nothingness forever until they died. And then the ground came up, fast. She saw the floor of the Accords Hall, hard marble veined with gold, before she hit it. The collision was hard, rattling her teeth. She rolled automatically, as she had been taught, and came to a stop at the side of the mermaid fountain in the center of the room. She sat up and looked around. The room was full of utterly silent, staring faces, but they didn't matter. She wasn't looking for strangers. She saw Jace first. He had landed in a crouch, poised to fight. She saw his shoulders relax as he looked around, realizing where they were, that they were in Idris, and the war was over. And there was Alec. He had his hand still in Magnus's. Magnus looked sick and exhausted, but he was alive. And there was Isabel. She had come through the closest to Clary, only a foot or so away. She was already on her feet, her gaze scanning the room once, twice, a desperate third time. They were all there, all of them. All, except one. She looked down at Clary. Her eyes were shining with tears.
"Simon's not here," she said. "He's really gone."
The silence that had held the assembly of shadow hunters in its grip seemed to break like a wave. Suddenly there were Nephilim running toward them. Clary saw her mother and Luke, Robert and Maris, Aline and Helen, even Emma Carstairs moving to surround them, to embrace them and to heal them and help them. Clary knew they meant well, that they were running to the rescue, but she felt no relief. Her hand tightening on the gold ring in her palm, she curled up against the floor and finally allowed herself to cry.
24. Call it peace. "Who stands then to represent the fairy courts?" said Gia Penhallow. The Hall of Accords was draped with the blue banners of victory. They looked like pieces cut out of the sky. Each was stamped with a golden rune of triumph. It was a clear winter day outside, and the light that poured through the windows shimmered across the long lines of chairs that had been set up facing the raised dais at the center of the room, where the consul and the inquisitor sat at a long table. The table itself was decorated with more gold and blue. Massive golden candlesticks that nearly obscured Emma's view of the Downworlders, who also shared the table. Luke, representing the werewolves, a young woman named Lily, representing the vampires, and the very famous Magnus Bane, the representative for the warlocks. No seat had been placed at the table for a representative of Faerie. Slowly, from among the seated crowd, a young woman rose to her feet. Her eyes were entirely blue with no white. Her ears pointed like Helen's. "I am Kaylee Whitewillow," she said. "I will stand for the Seelie Court." "But not for the Unseelie," said Gia, her pen hovering above a scroll of paper. Kaylee shook her head, her lips pressed together. A murmur ran through the room. For all the brightness of the banners, the mood in the room was tense, not joyful. In the row of seats in front of the Blackthorns sat the Lightwoods. Maris with her back ramrod straight, and beside her, Isabel and Alec, their dark heads bent together as they whispered. Jocelyn Fairchild sat beside Maris, but there was no sign anywhere of Clary Frey or Jace Lightwood. "The Unseelie Court declines a representative," said Gia, noting it down with her pen. She looked at Kaylee over the rims of her glasses. "What word do you bring us from the Seelie Court? Do they agree to our terms?" Emma heard Helen at the end of her row of seats take a deep breath. Drew and Tavi and the twins had been considered too young to come to this meeting. Technically, no one under 18 was allowed, but special conditions had been made for those, like her and Julian, who had been directly affected by what was coming to be called the Dark War. Kaylee moved along the aisle between the row of seats and began to walk towards the dais. Robert Lightwood rose to his feet. "You must ask permission to approach the consul," he said in his gravelly voice. "Permission is not given," said Gia tightly. "Stay where you are, Kaylee White Willow. I can hear you perfectly well." Emma felt a sudden brief burst of pity for the fairy girl. Everyone was staring at her with eyes like knives. Everyone except Aline and Helen, who sat pressed close together. They were holding each other's hands and their knuckles were white. "The fairy court asks for your mercy," Kaylee said, clasping her slim hands in front of her. "The terms you have set down are too harsh. The fairies have always had their own sovereignty, our own kings and queens. We have always had warriors. We are an ancient people. What you ask for will crush us completely." A low murmur ran around the room. It was not a friendly noise. Gia picked up the paper lying on the table in front of her. "Shall we review?" she said. "We ask that the fairy courts accept all responsibility for the loss of life and damage sustained by Shadowhunters and Downworlders in the Dark War. The fair folk shall be responsible for the costs of rebuilding broken wards, for the reestablishment of the Praetor Lupus on Long Island, and the rebuilding of what in Alicante has been destroyed. You will spend your own riches upon it. As for the Shadowhunters taken from us, if you mean Mark Blackthorne, he was taken by the Wild Hunt," Kaylee said. "We have no jurisdiction over them. You will have to negotiate with them yourselves, though we will not prevent it." "He was not all that was taken from us," said Gia. "There is that for which there could be no reparation, the loss of life sustained by Shadowhunters and Lycanthropes in battle, those who were torn from us by the Infernal Cup." "That was Sebastian Morgenstern, not the courts," Kaylee protested. "He was a Shadowhunter. And that's why we are not punishing you with a war that you would inevitably lose," said Gia coldly. "Instead, we insist merely that you disband your armies, that there be no more fair folk warriors. You may no longer bear arms. Any fairy found carrying a weapon without a dispensation from the Clave will be killed on sight." "The terms are too severe," Kaylee protested. "The fair folk cannot abide under them. If we are weaponless, we cannot defend ourselves." "We will put it to a vote then," said Gia, setting her paper down. "Any not in favor of the terms set down for the fair folk, please speak now." There was a long silence. Emma could see Helen's eyes roving the room, her mouth pinched at the sides. Aline was holding her wrist tightly. Finally, there was the sound of a chair scraping back, echoing in the silence, and one lone figure rose to his feet. Magnus Bane. He was still pale from his ordeal in Edom, but his gold-green eyes burned with an intensity that Emma could see from across the room. "I know that mundane history is not of enormous interest to most Shadowhunters," he said. "But there was a time before the Nephilim, a time when Rome battled the city of Carthage, and over the course of many wars was victorious. After one of the wars, Rome demanded that Carthage pay them tribute, that Carthage abandon their army, and that the land of Carthage be sowed with salt. The historian Tacitus said of the Romans that they make a desert and call it peace." He turned to Gia. "The Carthaginians never forgot. Their hatred of Rome sparked another war in the end, and that war ended in death and slavery. That was not peace. This is not peace." At that, there were catcalls from the assembly.
"Perhaps we don't want peace, Warlock," someone shouted. "What's your solution, then?" someone else shouted.
"Leniency," said Magnus. "The fair folk have long hated the Nephilim for their harshness. Show them something other than harshness, and you will receive something other than hate in return."
Noise burst out again, louder than ever this time. Gia raised a hand, and the crowd quieted.
"Does anyone else speak for the fair folk?" she asked.
Magnus, taking his seat again, glanced sideways at his fellow Downworlders, but Lily was smirking and Luke was staring down at the table with a fixed look on his face.
It was common knowledge that his sister had been the first taken and endarkened by Sebastian Morgenstern, that many of the wolves in the Praetor had been his friends, including Jordan Kyle, and yet there was doubt on his face. "Luke," Magnus said in his soft voice that somehow managed to echo through the room. "Please." The doubt vanished. Luke shook his head grimly. "Don't ask for what I can't give," he said. "The whole Praetor was slaughtered, Magnus. As a representative of the werewolves, I cannot speak against what they all want. If I did, they would turn against the Clave and nothing would be accomplished by that."
"There it is then," Gia said. "Speak, Kaylee White Willow. Will you agree to the terms, or will there be a war between us?"
The fairy girl bowed her head.
"We agree to the terms."
The assembly burst into applause. Only a few did not clap. Magnus, Thoreau of Blackthorns, the Lightwoods, and Emma herself. She was too busy watching Kaylee as the fairy sat down. Her head might have been bowed submissively, but her face was full of a white-hot rage.
"So it is done," said Gia, clearly pleased. "Now we move to the subject of..."
"Wait." A thin shadow hunter with dark hair had risen to his feet. Emma didn't recognize him. He could have been anyone, a Cartwright, a Pontmercy.
"There remains the question of Mark and Helen Blackthorn."
Helen's eyes closed. She looked like someone who had been half expecting a guilty sentence in a trial and half hoping for a reprieve. And this was the moment after the guilty sentence had fallen. Gia paused, her pen in her hand.
"What do you mean, Balog?"
Balog drew himself up.
"There's already been discussion of the fact that Morgenstern's forces penetrated the Los Angeles Institute so easily. Both Mark and Helen Blackthorn have the blood of fairies in them. We know the boy's already joined up with the Wild Hunt, so he's beyond us. But the girl shouldn't be among shadow hunters. It isn't decent."
Aline shot to her feet.
"That's ridiculous," she spat. "Helen's a shadow hunter. She's always been one. She's got the blood of the angel in her. You can't turn your back on that."
"And the blood of fairies," said Balog. "She can lie. We've already been tricked by one of her sort to our sorrow. I say we strip her marks."
Luke brought his hand down on the table with a loud slam. Magnus was hunched forward, his long-fingered hands covering his face, his shoulders slumped.
"The girl's done nothing," Luke said. "You can't punish her for an accident of birth."
"Accidents of birth make us all what we are," said Balog stubbornly. "You can't deny the fairy blood in her. You can't deny she can lie. If it comes down to a war again, where will her loyalty stand?"
Helen got to her feet.
"Where they stood this time," she said. "I fought at the Burn and at the Citadel and in Alicante to protect my family and protect Nephilim. I've never given any one reason to question my loyalty."
"This is what happens," Magnus said, raising his face. "Can't you see? This is how it begins again."
"Helen is right," said Gia. "She's done nothing wrong."
Another shadow hunter rose to her feet, a woman with dark hair piled on her head.
"Begging your pardon, Consul, but you are not objective," she said. "We all know of your daughter's relationship with the fairy girl. You should recuse yourself from this discussion."
"Helen Blackthorn is needed, Mrs. Sedgwick," said Diana Rayburn, standing. She looked outraged. Emma remembered her in the Accords Hall, the way she had tried to get to Emma to help her.
"Her parents have been murdered. She has 5 younger brothers and sisters to care for."
"She is not needed," snapped Sedgwick.
"We are reopening the academy. The children can go there or they can be split up among various institutes."
"No,"
Julian whispered, his hands were in fists on his knees.
"Absolutely not," Helen shouted. "Gia, you must..."
Gia met her eyes and nodded, a slow, reluctant nod.
"Arthur Blackthorn," she said, "please rise."
Emma felt Julian beside her freeze in shock as a man on the other side of the room, hidden among the crowd, rose to his feet. He was slight, a paler, smaller version of Julian's father, with thinning brown hair and the Blackthorn eyes, half hidden behind spectacles. He leaned heavily on a wooden cane, with a discomfort that made her think the injury that required the cane was recent.
"I wish to wait until after this meeting, that the children might meet their uncle properly," Gia said.
I summoned him immediately on news of the attack on the Los Angeles Institute, of course, but he had been injured in London. He arrived in Idris only this morning. She sighed. Mr. Blackthorne, you may introduce yourself. The man had a round, pleasant face and looked extremely uncomfortable being stared at by so many people.
I am Arthur Blackthorne, Andrew Blackthorne's brother, he said. His accent was British.
Emma always forgot that Julian's father had originally come from London. He had lost his accent years before.
I will be moving into the Los Angeles Institute as soon as possible and bringing my nieces and nephews with me. The children will be under my protection.
Is that really your uncle? Emma whispered, staring.
Yes, that's him, Julian whispered back, clearly agitated. It's just I was really starting to think he wouldn't come. I'd rather have Helen look after us.
Well, I'm sure we're all immeasurably relieved that you'll be looking after the Blackthorne children, said Luke.
Helen is one of them. Are you saying, by claiming responsibility for the younger siblings, that you agree that her mark should be stripped?
Arthur Blackthorne looked horrified.
Not at all, he said. My brother may not have been wise in his dalliances, but all records show that the children of Shadowhunters are Shadowhunters. As they say, ut incepit fidelis sic permanet.
Julian slid down in his seat. More Latin, he muttered, just like Dad.
What does it mean? Emma asked.
She begins loyal and ends loyal, something like that. Julian's eyes flicked around the room. Everyone was muttering and glaring. Gia was in muted conference with Robert and the Downworld representatives. Helen was still standing, but it looked as if Aline was all that was holding her up. The group at the dais broke apart, and Robert Lightwood stepped forward. His face was thunderous.
So that there is no discussion that Gia's personal friendship with Helen Blackthorne will have influenced her decision, she has recused herself, he said. The rest of us have decided that, as Helen is 18, at the age where many Shadowhunters are posted to other institutes to learn their ways, she will be posted to Wrangell Island to study the wards.
For how long? Said Balog immediately.
Indefinitely, said Robert, and Helen sank down into her chair. Aline at her side, her face a mask of grief and shock.
Wrangell Island might have been the seat of all the wards that protected the world, a prestigious posting in many ways, but it was also a tiny island in the frozen Arctic Sea north of Russia, thousands of miles from Los Angeles.
Is that good enough for you? Gia said in a cold voice.
Mr. Balog?
Mrs. Sedgwick? Should we vote on it?
All in favor of assigning Helen Blackthorne to a posting on Wrangell Island until her loyalty is determined, say aye.
A chorus of aye and a quieter chorus of nay ran around the room. Emma said nothing and neither did Jules. Both of them were too young to vote. Emma reached her hand over and took Julian's, squeezed it tightly. His fingers were like ice. He had the look of someone who had been hit so many times that they no longer even wanted to get up. Helen was sobbing softly in Aline's arms.
There remains the question of Mark Blackthorne, said Balog.
What question? Demanded Robert Lightwood, sounding exasperated. The boy has been taken by the Wild Hunt in the unlikely event that we are able to negotiate his release. Shouldn't this be a problem to worry about then?
That's just it, said Balog. As long as we don't negotiate his release, the problem takes care of itself. The boy is likely better off with his own kind anyway.
Arthur Blackthorne's round face paled.
No, he said. My brother wouldn't have wanted that. He'd have wanted the boy at home with his family.
He gestured toward where Emma and Julian and the rest were sitting.
They've had so much taken away from them. How can we take more?
We're protecting them, snapped Sedgwick. From a brother and sister who will only betray them as time passes and they realize their true loyalty to the courts. All in favor of permanently abandoning the search for Mark Blackthorne, say aye.
Emma reached to hold Julian as he hunched forward in his chair. She clung awkwardly to his side. All of his muscles were rigid, as hard as iron, as if he were readying himself for a fall or a blow. Helen leaned toward him, whispering and murmuring, her own face streaked with tears.
As Aline reached past Helen to stroke Jules's hair, Emma caught sight of the blackthorn ring sparkling on Aline's finger. As the chorus of I went around the room in a terrible symphony, the gleam made Emma think of the shine of a distress signal far out at sea, when no one could see it, where there was no one to care. If this was peace and victory, Emma thought, maybe war and fighting was better after all. Jay slid from the back of the horse and reached up a hand to help Clary down after him. Here we are, he said, turning to face the lake. They stood on a shallow beach of rocks facing the western edge of Lake Lynn. It was not the same beach where Valentine had stood when he had summoned the angel Raziel. Not the same beach where Jace had bled his life out and then regained it. But Clary had not been back to the lake since that time, and the sight of it still sent a shiver through her bones. It was a lovely place, there was no doubt about that. The lake stretched into the distance, tinted with the color of the winter sky, limned in silver, the surface brushed and rippled so that it resembled a piece of metallic paper folding and unfolding under the wind's touch. The clouds were white and high, and the hills around them were bare. Clary moved forward, down to the edge of the water. She had thought her mother might come with her, but at the last moment Jocelyn had refused, saying that she had bidden goodbye to her son a long time ago, and that this was Clary's time. The clave had burned his body, at Clary's request. The burning of a body was an honour, and those who died in disgrace were buried at crossroads, whole and unburned, as Jace's mother had been. The burning had been more than a favour, Clary thought. It had been a sure way for the clave to be absolutely certain that he was dead. But still, Jonathan's ashes were never to be taken to the abode of the Silent Brothers. They would never form a part of the City of Bones. He would never be a soul among other Nephilim souls. He would not be buried among those he had caused to be murdered, and that, Clary thought, was only fair and just. The Andarkand had been burned, and their ashes buried at the crossroads near Brosland. There would be a monument there, an acropolis to recall those who had once been shadow hunters, but there would be no monument to recall Jonathan Morgenstern, whom no one wanted to remember. Even Clary wished she could forget, but nothing was that easy. The water of the lake was clear, with a slight rainbow sheen to it like a slick of oil. It lapped against the edges of Clary's boots as she opened the silver box she was holding. Inside it were ashes, powdery and grey, flecked with bits of charred bone. Among the ashes lay the Morgenstern ring, glimmering in silver. It had been on a chain around Jonathan's throat when he had been burned, and it remained untouched and unharmed by the fire. I never had a brother, she said. Not really. She felt Jace place his hand on her back between her shoulder blades. You did, he said. You had Simon. He was your brother in all the ways that matter. He watched you grow up, defended you, fought with and for you, cared about you all your life. He was the brother you chose. Even if he's gone now, no one and nothing can take that away from you. Clary took a deep breath and flung the box as far as she could. It flew far, over the rainbow water, black ashes arcing out behind it like the plume of a jet plane, and the ring fell along with it, turning over and over, sending out silver sparks as it fell and disappeared beneath the water. Awe atque wale, she said, speaking the full lines of the ancient poem. Awe atque wale in perpetuum frater. Hail and farewell forever, my brother. The wind off the lake was cold. She felt it against her face, icy on her cheeks, and only then did she realize that she had been crying, and that her face was cold because it was wet with tears. She had wondered since she had found out that Jonathan was alive why her mother had cried on the day of his birth every year. Why cry if she hated him? But Clary understood now. Her mother had been crying for the child she would never have, for all the dreams that had been wrapped up in her imagination of having a son, her imagination of what that boy would be like. And she'd been crying for the bitter chance that had destroyed that child before he had ever been born. And so, as Jocelyn had for so many years, Clary stood at the side of the mortal mirror and wept for the brother she would never have, for the boy who had never been given the chance to live. And she wept as well for the others lost in the dark war, and she wept for her mother and the loss she had endured,
and she wept for Emma and the Blackthorns, remembering how they had fought back tears when she had told them that she had seen Mark in the tunnels of Faerie, and how he belonged to the hunt now. And she wept for Simon and the hole in her heart where he had been, and the way she would miss him every day until she died. And she wept for herself and the changes that had been wrought in her, because sometimes even change for the better felt like a little death. Jace stood by her side as she cried and held her hand silently until Jonathan's ashes had sunk under the water's surface without a trace. "Don't eavesdrop," said Julian. Emma glared at him. All right, so she could hear the raised voices through the thick wood of the consul's office door, now shut but for a crack, and maybe she had been leaning towards the door, tantalized by the fact that she could hear the voices, could nearly make them out, but not quite. So, wasn't it better to know things than to not know them? She mouthed, "So what?" at Julian, who raised his eyebrows at her. Julian didn't exactly like rules, but he obeyed them. Emma thought rules were for breaking, or bending at the very least. Plus, she was bored. They had been led to the door and left there by one of the council members, at the end of the long corridor that stretched nearly the length of the guard. Tapestries hung all around the office entrance, threadbare from the passing of years. Most of them showed passages from Shadowhunter history. The angel rising from the lake with immortal instruments, the angel passing the grey book to Jonathan Shadowhunter, the First Accords, the Battle of Shanghai, the Council of Buenos Aires. There was another tapestry as well, this one looking newer and freshly hung, which showed the angel rising out of the lake, this time without the mortal instruments. A blonde man stood at the edge of the lake, and near him, almost invisible, was the figure of a slight girl with red hair holding a steely. "There'll be a tapestry about you someday," said Jules. Emma flicked her eyes over to him. "You have to do something really big to get a tapestry about you, like win a war." "You could win a war," he said confidently. Emma felt a little tightening around her heart. When Julian looked at her like that, like she was brilliant and amazing, it made the missing her parents ache in her heart a little less. There was something about having someone care about you like that that made you feel like you could never be totally alone. Unless they decided to take her away from Jules, of course. Move her to Idris or to one of the institutes where she had distant relatives, in England or China or Iran. Suddenly panicked, she took out her steely and carved an audio rune in her arm before pressing her ear to the wood of the door, ignoring Julian's glare. The voices immediately came clear. She recognized Gia's first, and then the second after a beat. The consul was talking to Luke Garraway. "Zachariah, he's no longer an active shadow hunter," Gia was saying. "He left today before the meeting, saying he had some loose ends to tie up, and then an urgent appointment in London in early January, something he couldn't miss." Luke murmured an answer Emma didn't hear. She hadn't known Zachariah was leaving, and wished she could have thanked him for the help he'd given them the night of the battle, and asked him how he'd known her middle name was Cordelia. She leaned in more closely to the door and heard Luke halfway through a sentence. "Should tell you first," he was saying. "I'm planning to step down as representative. Maya Roberts will take my place." Gia made a surprised noise. "Isn't she a little young?" "She's very capable," said Luke. "She hardly needs my endorsement." "No," Gia agreed. "Without her warning before Sebastian's attack, we would have lost many more shadow hunters than we did. And as she'll be leading the New York pack from now on, it makes more sense for her to be your representative than for me." He sighed. "Besides, Gia, I've lost my sister. Jocelyn lost her son again. And Clary's still devastated over what happened with Simon. I'd like to be there for my daughter." Gia made an unhappy noise. "Maybe I shouldn't have let her try to call him." "She had to know," said Luke. "It's a loss. She has to come to terms with it. She has to grieve. I'd like to be there to help her through it. I'd like to get married. I'd like to be there for my family. I need to step away."
"Well, you have my blessing, of course," she said. "Though I could have used your help in reopening the academy. We have lost so many. It has been a long time since death undid so many Nephilim. We must reach out into the mundane world
Find those who might ascend, teach and train them. There will be a great deal to do.
And many to help you do it.
Luke's tone was inflexible.
Gia sighed.
I'll welcome Maya, no fear. Poor Magnus surrounded by women.
I doubt he'll mind or notice, said Luke. Though I should say that you know he was right, Gia. Abandoning the search for Mark Blackthorne, sending Helen Blackthorne to Wrangell Island, that was unconscionable cruelty.
There was a pause, and then... I know, said Gia in a low voice. You think I don't know what I did to my own daughter? But letting Helen stay, I saw the hate in the eyes of my own shadow hunters, and I was afraid for Helen. Afraid for Mark, should we be able to find him?
Well, I saw the devastation in the eyes of the Blackthorne children, said Luke.
Children are resilient.
They've lost their brother and their father, and now you're leaving them to be raised by an uncle they've seen only a few times.
They will come to know him. He is a good man. Diana Rayburn has requested the position of their tutor as well, and I am inclined to give it to her. She was impressed by their bravery.
But she isn't their mother. My mother left when I was a child, Luke said. She became an Iron Sister, Cleophas. I never saw her again. Amatis raised me. I don't know what I would have done without her. She was all I had.
Emma glanced quickly over at Julian to see if he'd heard. She didn't think he had. He wasn't looking at her, but was staring off into nothing, blue-green eyes as distant as the ocean they resembled. She wondered if he was remembering the past or fearing the future. She wished she could rewind the clock, get her parents back, give Jules his father and Helen and Mark. Unbreak what was broken.
I'm sorry about Amatis, said Gia. And I am worried about the Blackthorn children, believe me. But we have always had orphans, we're Nephilim. You know that as well as I do. As for the Carstairs girl, she will be brought to Idris. I'm worried she might be a little headstrong.
Emma shoved the door of the office open. It gave much more easily than she had anticipated, and she half fell inside. She heard Jules give a startled yelp and then followed her, grabbing at the back of the belt on her jeans to pull her upright.
No, she said.
Both Gia and Luke looked at her in surprise. Gia's mouth partly open, Luke beginning to crack a smile.
A little, he said.
Emma Carstairs, Gia began rising to her feet. How dare you?
How dare you?
And Emma was utterly surprised that it was Julian who had spoken, his verdigris eyes blazing. In 5 seconds he had turned from worried boy to furious young man, his brown hair standing out wildly as if it were angry too.
How dare you, shouted Emma, when you're the one who promised. You promised the Clave would never abandon Mark while he was living. You promised.
Gia had the grace to look ashamed. He is one of the Wild Hunt now, she said. They are neither the dead nor the living.
So you knew, said Julian. You knew when you promised that it didn't mean anything.
It meant saving Idris, said Gia. I am sorry. We needed the two of you, and I... She sounded as if she were choking out the words. I would have fulfilled the promise if I could. If there were any way... If it could be done, I would see it done.
Then you owe us, Emma said, planting her feet firmly in front of the consul's desk. You owe us a broken promise, so you have to do this now.
Do what? Gia looked bewildered.
I won't be moved to Idris. I won't. I belong in Los Angeles.
Emma felt Jules freeze up behind her.
Of course I'm not moving you to Idris, he said. What are you talking about?
Emma pointed an accusing finger at Gia.
She said it.
Absolutely not, Julian said. Emma lives in L.A. It's her home. She can stay at the Institute. That's what Shadowhunters do. The Institute is supposed to be a refuge.
Your uncle will be running the Institute, said Gia. It's up to him.
What did he say? Julian demanded, and behind those 4 words were a wealth of feeling. When Julian loved people, he loved them forever. When he hated them forever. Emma had the feeling the question of whether he was going to hate his uncle forever hung in the balance at exactly this moment.
He said he would take her in, Gia said.
But really, I think there's a place for Emma at the Shadowhunter Academy here in Idris. She's exceptionally talented, she'd be surrounded by the best instructors. There are many other students who'd suffered losses and could help her with her grief. Her grief. Emma's mind suddenly swam through images. The photos of her parents' bodies on the beach, covered in markings. The Clay's clear lack of interest in what had happened to them. Her father bending to kiss her before he walked off to the car where her mother waited. Their laughter on the wind. I've suffered losses, Julian said through clenched teeth. I can help her. You're 12, said Gia, as if that answered everything. I won't be always, Julian shouted. Emma and I, we've known each other all our lives. She's like... We're going to be Parabatai, Emma said suddenly, before Julian could say that she was like his sister. For some reason, she didn't want to hear that. Everyone's eyes snapped wide open, including Julian's. Julian asked me, and I said yes, she said. We're 12, we're old enough to make the decision. Luke's eyes sparked as he looked at her. You can't split up Parabatai, he said. It's against the Clave's law. We need to be able to train together, Emma said. To take the examinations together, to do the ritual together. Yes, yes, I understand, said Gia. Very well. Your uncle doesn't mind, Julian, if Emma lives in the Institute, and the institution of Parabatai trumps all other considerations. She looked from Emma to Julian, whose eyes were shining. He looked happy, actually happy, for the first time in so long that Emma nearly couldn't remember the last time she'd seen him smile like that. You're sure? The consul added. Becoming Parabatai is serious business, nothing to be undertaken lightly. It's a commitment. You'll have to look out for each other, protect each other, care for the other one more than you care for yourself. We already do, said Julian confidently. It took Emma a moment more to speak. She was still seeing her parents in her head. Los Angeles held the answers to what had happened to them. Answers she needed. If no one ever avenged their deaths, it would be as if they had never lived at all. And it wasn't as if she didn't want to be Jules's Parabatai. The thought of a whole life spent without ever being separated from him, a promise that she would never be alone, trumped the voice in the back of her head that whispered, Wait. She nodded firmly. Absolutely, she said. We're absolutely sure. Idris had been green and gold and russet in the autumn when Clary had first been there. It had a stark grandeur in the late winter, so close to Christmas. The mountains rose in the distance, capped white with snow, and the trees along the side of the road that led back to Alicante from the lake were stripped bare, their leafless branches making lace-like patterns against the bright sky. They rode without haste, wayfarer treading lightly along the path, Clary behind Jace, her arms clasped around his torso. Sometimes he would slow the horse to point out the manor houses of the richer Shadowhunter families, hidden from the road when the trees were full, but revealed now. She felt his shoulders tense as they passed one, whose ivy-covered stones nearly melded with the forest around it. It had clearly been burned to the ground and rebuilt. Blackthorn Manor, he said. Which means that around this bend in the road is... He paused as Wayfarer summited a small hill, and then Jace reined him in so they could look down to where the road split in two. One direction led back to Alicante. Clary could see the demon towers in the distance, while the other curled down toward a large building of mellow golden stone, surrounded by a low wall. Herondale Manor, Jace finished. The wind picked up, icy. It ruffled Jace's hair. Clary had her hood up, but he was bareheaded and barehanded, having said that he hated wearing gloves when horseback riding. He liked to feel the reins in his hands. Did you want to go and look at it? She asked. His breath came out in a white cloud. I'm not sure. She pressed closer to him, shivering. Are you worried about missing the council meeting? She had been, though they were returning to New York tomorrow, and there had been no other time she could think of to secretly lay her brother's ashes to rest. It was Jace who had suggested taking the horse from the stables and riding to Lake Lynn, when nearly everyone else in Alicante was sure to be in the Accords Hall. Jace understood what it meant to her to bury the idea of her brother, though it would have been hard to explain to almost anyone else. He shook his head. We're too young to vote. Besides, I think they can manage without us. He frowned. We'd have to break in, he said. The consul told me that as long as I want to call myself Jace Lightwood, I've got no legal right to the Herondale properties. I don't even have a Herondale ring. One doesn't exist. The Iron Sisters would have to craft a new one. In fact, when I turn 18, I'll lose the right to the name entirely. Clary sat still, holding onto his waist lightly. There were times when he wanted to be prompted and asked questions, and times when he didn't. This was one of the latter. He would get there on his own. She held him and breathed quietly, until he suddenly tensed under her hold and dug his heels into Wayfarer's sides. The horse headed down the path toward the manor house at a trot. The low gates, decorated with an iron motif of flying birds, were open, and the path opened out into a circular gravel drive, in the center of which was a stone fountain, now dry. Jace drew up in front of the wide steps that led to the front door and stared up at the blank windows. "This is where I was born," he said. "This is where my mother died and Valentine cut me out of her body. And Hodge took me and hid me so no one would know. It was winter then, too." "Jace," she splayed her hands over his chest, feeling his heartbeat under her fingers. "I think I want to be a Herondale," he said abruptly.
"So be a Herondale."
"I don't want to betray the Lightwoods," he said. "They're my family. But I realize that if I don't take the Herondale name, it'll end with me."
"It's not your responsibility."
"I know," he said. "In the box, the one Armitage gave me, there was a letter from my father to me. He wrote it before I was born. I read it a few times. The first time I read it, I just hated him, even though he said he loved me. But there were a few sentences I couldn't get rid of in my head. He said, 'I want you to be a better man than I was. Let no one else tell you who you are or should be.'" He tipped his head back, as if he could read his future in the curl of the manor's eaves. "Changing your name, it doesn't change your nature. Look at Sebastian, Jonathan. Calling himself Sebastian didn't make any difference in the end. I wanted to spurn the Herondale name because I thought I hated my father, but I don't hate him. He might have been weak and made the wrong decisions, but he knew it. There's no reason for me to hate him, and there have been generations of Herondales before him. It's a family that's done a lot of good. And to let their whole house fall just to get back at my father would be a waste."
"That's the first time I've heard you call him your father and sound like that," Clary said. "Usually you only say it about Valentine."
She felt him sigh, and then his hand covered hers where it lay on his chest. His fingers were cool, long, and slender, so familiar she would have known them in the dark. "We might live here someday," he said, "together." She smiled, knowing he couldn't see her, but unable to help it.
"Think you can win me over with a fancy house?" she said.
"Don't get ahead of yourself, Jace. Jace Herondale," she added and wrapped her arms around him in the cold.
Alex sat at the edge of the roof, dangling his feet over the side. He supposed that if either of his parents came back to the house and looked up, they'd see him, and he'd get shouted at. But he doubted Maris or Robert would return soon. They'd been called to the consul's office, after the meeting, and were probably still there. The new treaty with the fair folk would be hammered out over the next week, during which they'd stay in Idris, while the rest of the Lightwoods went back to New York and celebrated the new year without them. Alec would, technically, be running the Institute for that week. He was surprised to find that he was actually looking forward to it. Responsibility was a good way to take your mind off other things. Things like the way Jocelyn had looked when her son had died, or the way Clary had stifled her silent sobs against the floor when she'd realized that they'd come back from Edom, but without Simon. The way Magnus's face had looked, bleak with despair, as he'd said his father's name. Loss was part of being a shadow hunter. You expected it. But that didn't help the way Alec had felt when he'd seen Helen's expression in the council hall as she'd been exiled to Wrangel Island. "You couldn't have done anything. Don't punish yourself." The voice behind him was familiar. Alec squeezed his eyes shut, trying to steady his breathing before he replied. "How'd you get up here?" he asked. There was a rustle of fabric as Magnus settled himself down next to Alec at the edge of the roof. Alec chanced a sideways glance at him. He'd seen Magnus only twice, briefly, since they'd returned from Edom. Once when the Silent Brothers had released them from quarantine, and once again today in the Council Hall. Neither time had they been able to talk. Alec looked him over with a yearning he suspected was poorly disguised. Magnus was back to his healthy, normal color after the drained look he had had in Edom. His bruises were largely healed, and his eyes were bright again, glinting under the dimming sky. Alec remembered throwing his arms around Magnus in the demon realm, when he'd found him chained up, and wondered why things like that were always so much easier to do when you thought you were about to die. "I should have said something," Alec said. "I voted against sending her away." "I know," said Magnus. "You and about 10 other people. It was overwhelmingly in favor." He shook his head. "People get scared, and then they take it out on anyone they think is different. It's the same cycle I've seen 1,000 times. It makes me feel so useless. You're anything but useless." Magnus tipped his head back, his eyes searching the sky as the stars began to make their appearances, one by one. "You saved my life." "In Edom," Alec said. "I helped, but really, you saved your own life." "Not just in Edom," Magnus said. I'm almost 400 years old, Alexander. Warlocks, as they get older, they start to calcify. They stop being able to feel things, to care, to be excited or surprised. I always told myself that would never happen to me, that I'd try to be like Peter Pan, never grow up, always retain a sense of wonder, always fall in love, be surprised, be open to being hurt as much as I was open to being happy. But over the last 20 years or so, I felt it creeping up on me anyway. There was nobody before you for a long time. Nobody I loved. No one who surprised me or took my breath away. Until you walked into that party. I was starting to think I'd never feel anything that strongly again." Alec caught his breath and looked down at his hands. "What are you saying?" His voice was uneven. "That you want to get back together. If you want to," Magnus said. It actually sounded uncertain, enough that Alec looked at him in surprise. Magnus looked very young, his eyes wide and gold-green, his hair brushing his temples in wisps of black. "If you..." Alec sat, frozen. For weeks he'd sat and daydreamed about Magnus saying these exact words, but now that Magnus was, it didn't feel the way he'd thought it would. There were no fireworks in his chest. He felt empty and cold. "I don't know," he said. The light died out of Magnus's eyes. He said, "Well, I can understand that you... I wasn't very kind to you." "No," Alec said bluntly. "You weren't, but I guess it's hard to break up with someone kindly. The thing is, I am sorry about what I did. I was wrong. Incredibly wrong. But the reason I did it, that isn't going to change. I can't go through my life feeling like I don't know you at all. You keep saying the past is the past, but the past made you who you are. I want to know about your life, and if you're not willing to tell me about it, then I shouldn't be with you. Because I know me, and I won't ever be okay with it, so I shouldn't put us both through that again." Magnus pulled his knees up to his chest. In the darkening twilight, he looked gangly against the shadows, all long legs and arms and thin fingers sparkling with rings. "I love you," he said quietly. "Don't," Alec said. "Don't. It's not fair. Besides..." He glanced away. "I doubt I'm the first one who ever broke your heart." "My heart's been broken more times than the Clave's Law about Shadowhunters not engaging in romances with downworlders," Magnus said. But his voice sounded brittle. "Alec, you're right." Alec cut his eyes sideways. He didn't think he'd ever seen the warlock look so vulnerable. "It's not fair to you," Magnus said. "I've always told myself I was going to be open to new experiences, and so when I started to harden, I was shocked. I thought I'd done everything right, not closed my heart off. And then I thought about what you said, and I realized why I was starting to die inside. If you never tell anyone the truth about yourself, eventually you start to forget. The love, the heartbreak, the joy, the despair, the things I did that were good, the things I did that were shameful. If I kept them all inside, my memories of them would start to disappear. And then I would disappear. Alec wasn't sure what to say. I had a lot of time to think after we broke up, Magnus said. And I wrote this. He pulled a notebook out of the inside pocket of his jacket. Just a very ordinary, spiral-bound notebook of lined paper. But when the wind flapped it open, Alec could see that the pages were covered with thin, looping handwriting. Magnus's handwriting. I wrote down my life. Alec's eyes widened.
Your whole life?
Not all of it, Magnus said carefully. But some of the incidents that have shaped me. How I first met Raphael when he was very young, Magnus said, and sounded sad. How I fell in love with Camille. The story of the Hotel du Mort, though Katerina had to help me with that. Some of my early loves, and some of my later ones. Names you might know. Herondale. Will Herondale, said Alec. Camille mentioned him. He took the notebook. The thin pages felt bumpy, as if Magnus had pressed the pen very hard into the paper while writing. Were you with him? Magnus laughed and shook his head. No, though. There are a lot of Herondales in the pages. Will's son, James Herondale, was remarkable, and so was James' sister, Lucy. But I have to say, Stephen Herondale really put me off the family until Jace came along. That guy was a pill. He noticed Alec staring at him and added quickly, No Herondales. No Shadowhunters at all, in fact.
No Shadowhunters?
None in my heart like you are, Magnus said. He tapped the notebook lightly. Consider this a first installment of everything I want to tell you. I wasn't sure, but I hoped. If you wanted to be with me, as I want to be with you, you might take this as evidence. Evidence that I'm willing to give you something I have never given anyone. My past. The truth of myself. I want to share my life with you, and that means today, and the future, and all of my past. If you want it. If you want me. Alec lowered the notebook. There was writing on the first page, a scrawled inscription. Dear Alec. He could see the path in front of him very clearly. He could hand back the book, walk away from Magnus, find someone else, some shadow hunter to love, be with him, share the kinship of predictable days and nights, the daily poetry of an ordinary life. Or he could take the step out into nothingness and choose Magnus, the far stranger poetry of him, his brilliance and anger, his sulks and joys, the extraordinary abilities of his magic, and the no less breathtaking magic of the extraordinary way he loved. It was hardly a choice at all. Alec took a deep breath and jumped. All right, he said. Magnus whipped toward him in the dark, all coiled energy now, all cheekbones and shimmering eyes.
Really?
Really, Alec said. He reached out a hand and interlinked his fingers with Magnus's. There was a glow being woken in Alec's chest, where all had been dark. Magnus cupped his long fingers under Alec's jawline and kissed him, his touch light against Alec's skin, a slow and gentle kiss, a kiss that promised more later, when they were no longer on a roof and could be seen by anyone walking by.
So I'm your first ever shadow hunter, huh?
Alec said when they separated at last. You're my first so many things, Alec Lightwood, Magnus said.
The sun was setting when Jace dropped Clary off at Armitage's house, kissed her, and headed back down the canal towards the Inquisitors. Clary watched him walk away before turning back to the house with a sigh. She was glad they were leaving the next day. There were things she loved about Idris. Alicante was still the loveliest city she'd ever seen. Over the houses now, she could see the sunset striking sparks off the clear tops of the demon towers. The rows of houses along the canal were softened by shadow, like velvet silhouettes. But it was heart-achingly sad being inside Armitage's house, knowing now, with certainty, that she would never come back to it.
Inside the house was warm and dimly lit. Luke was sitting on the sofa reading a book. Jocelyn was asleep beside him, curled up with a throw rug over her. Luke smiled at Clary as she came in, and he pointed toward the kitchen, making a bizarre gesture that Clary translated as an indication that there was food in there if she wanted it. She nodded and tiptoed up the stairs, careful not